dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week's ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court that campaign finance laws abridge the First Amendment rights of corporations serves to demonstrate why the issue of citizen organizing to bring down corporate rule is a prerequisite for effectively dealing with almost every societal problem. Because it goes to the core issue of the power to decide how we want to live. This week, I'm going to continue reading from Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy published by the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, POCLAD. I'll also play for you material from people involved in dismantling the laws that enable corporate rule. We'll begin with an interview with Richard Grossman of POCLAD, whose essays I've been reading. This interview was done a few years ago by Bill Houston of WHRW in Binghamton, New York. But it may as well have been done yesterday.
Many people today feel a loss of control over their own lives. Often this feeling is general and vague, and people don't really know exactly the source of their malaise. While we are free to vote, somehow our candidates do not seem to represent us. Our most cherished principles have been usurped and co-opted. For example, freedom has been equated with freedom of consumer choice. And while we have a constitutional guarantee to free speech, our information channels seem overloaded with speech which is mostly mindless or promoting things which does not represent our values or the best interest of living things on the planet. Today we have as our guest Mr. Richard L. Grossman, who has been described as the man who sparked the modern anti-corporate movement. Grossman is a researcher and a writer for the Massachusetts-based Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, also known as POCLAD, which he co-founded in 1994. Grossman graduated from Columbia University in 1965. Grossman served in the Peace Corps in the Philippines in the mid-1960s. And was a safe energy anti-nuclear activist in California in the early 1970s. He acted as an educator and a writer in Washington, D.C. In 1976, he returned to Washington, D.C. to become director of Environmentalists for Full Employment, a position he held until 1985. During this time, he authored Energy, Jobs, and the Economy, and Fear at Work, Job, Blackmail, Labor, and the Environment. And throughout the 1980s, Grossman worked with Greenpeace, where he served as executive director, and the Highlander Center. He was co-founder of the Highlander Center's Stop the Poisoning Schools in Newmarket, Tennessee. In 1985, he became a guest fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and began publishing the Wrenching Debate Gazette, an environmental newsletter. In 1993, Grossman co-authored the pamphlet Taking Care of Business, Citizenship, and the Charter of Incorporation, which really broke ground in this area of understanding problems with corporations. In around 1995, Grossman co-founded with Ward Morehouse the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, which studies the way corporations have become intrusive into the day-to-day operations of government and seeks ways to unentangle the two institutions so that individual citizens, not corporations, govern the country. POCLAD publishes a quarterly newsletter, By What Authority?, and has published two books, Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy, and Elite Consensus. Richard, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
I'd like to start out the program on a kind of a provocative note. Benito Mussolini said that fascism should be more appropriately called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power. Would you agree with that, and would you say that we are living in a fascist state?
Well, Franklin Roosevelt said something similar about the merging of what he called private power controlling public power. I think that's how he put it. And to him, that was fascism. And I think we have an awful lot of private power controlling public power. I think we live in a corporate state, yes. And I think if it was 1830 and people were asking what kind of state we lived in, and people answered, we live in a slave nation, I think that would be just as accurate. In that, what I mean is that the way things are ordered and structured is to ensure the supremacy of the corporations now, as it were, as things were structured to secure the supremacy of the slave masters in the 1830s.
Would you say that the slave masters are they have the same character, but maybe they've just changed form since then till now?
No, I think there's an awful lot that's different, but I think the similarities are that it's a relatively small class of people who are able to, in those days, were able to wield the coercive power of the state and of the culture for their principles and their values. And that meant denying massive amounts of people their fundamental rights. And I think today we have a relatively small number of people working through corporations, a class of people, who also are able to use the coercive force of government and the law of the land and the rule of law to impose their values and to deny a majority of people their fundamental rights.
Now,
I wonder if your listeners think that's really provocative or most people would agree. I'd be very curious to know.
You know, we've got all these founding documents in our country, like the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. You know, the second paragraph says, governments were instituted among men, which derived their just power from the consent of the governed. And, you know, the preamble for the Constitution talks about we the people. Yet you've written, you co-wrote an essay which appeared in the fall 2000, By What Authority?, entitled Rumors of USA Democracy Discovered to be Counterfeit. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, when a minority rules, you don't have a democracy. I think we have a minority that rules here.
Is it the minority of, is it a plutocracy? Is it the rich, or is it the investor class, the capitalist class?
It's generally a corporate class. There's some very wealthy families too. But pretty much it's what we could call the corporate class, since the corporation is the dominant institution of our time, and we have a corporate class that really exercises governing power and authority in this country, which is why it's so difficult for citizens, even citizens who organize together and invest a huge amount of time and energy, to make really substantial changes in public policy and public law from the very beginning. I mean, think how long it took to get rid of slavery. Think of how long it took, how many generations for women to get the right to vote. Think of how many generations to get child labor laws. You know, how long does it take to close or do something with a company that's pouring out, you know, thousands of pounds or tons of toxic chemicals into the air and the water every day? It takes a very long time to change policy. And that's because the document, the Constitution, one of the documents you mentioned, is a document. It's a plan of governance to enable a minority of people to control the majority.
Now, let me ask you. You just mentioned, corporations that are involved in polluting the environment, and I see, you know, as I researched your biography, that you have quite a bit of work in the area of environmental study and environmental activism, including your work with Greenpeace. Would you say that your work in these areas has somehow influenced you into exploring the corporate form?
Well, it's more than that. I started off in the employment field and worked back in the 60s, actually. I worked a lot in communities with people having difficulty finding jobs, with what were called at-risk populations. And when I was in Washington, including migrant workers and poor urban workers, and when I was in Washington with Environmental Full Employment that you mentioned, we we were sort of crossing over, joining both the labor side and the environmental side. And I think that that's characterized my work life, that the two big issues have been worker rights and earth rights, environmental rights. And my sort of hands-on experience in those realms, retrospectively, was quite logical. Brought me to the doors of corporate boardrooms and to the Constitution and to all the stuff that Polkland has been looking at. Because even, as I was suggesting before, even when people organize like crazy and even pass laws over the course of many years to try to remedy the situation that they were in, it became clear that the victories were not sufficient, and that something else was going on, and that the people within the corporations behind this corporate shield were, you know, every time and every issue and every campaign were wielding far more power, you know, disproportionate to their numbers, than the masses of people who were, you know, organizing to stop something or to try to translate their vision into some kind of positive public policy. I remember when I worked in California, I worked on the first statewide anti-nuclear initiative back in the mid-70s. And, you know, we all took it for granted that, you know, the largest contributors to the other side were virtually every major corporation in the country and banks and all of that. And we all took it for granted that they could pour in these, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars to dwarf the money that we were able to raise among people. And we, you know, we never questioned that. But, I mean, that's one of the things that we began to question 20 years later. I mean, why is that the norm? Why should, if people want to do an initiative to pass a law in a country that's supposed to be about consent of the governed, why is it that it's perfectly legal and normal and accepted in the culture for corporations to pour their millions of dollars into the village square, into the body politic, in order to drown out the voices of human beings, in order to deny people their rights to speak?
Let's go back to the basics and talk about first principles. When we speak about a corporation, what exactly are we talking about? Is it a legal entity, a political entity?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. On one level, it's a creation of the state. It's a legal entity. It's a bundle of rights. It's a, you know, concoction of the state. It enables a few people to come together and pool the resources of many people. And if you do that today, as soon as you become a corporation, as soon as some people pay a fee and file the forms with the state and become a corporation, because of the history that we've had in this country, immediately that entity or the people within that entity, clothed by the corporate shield, are able to exercise more rights under the Constitution, more power than ordinary people. So on one level, the corporation is, you know, a commercial enterprise if it's formed in order to make money or to make a product. But on another level, the corporation, as it's evolved in this country, and as some of the early corporations in the 17th century, like the East India Company, they are governing entities. They are entities created in order to impose certain values and certain ways of life upon other people. And to the extent that they're backed by the state, they're successful. So I think, you know, a corporation is not just a business enterprise or a charitable entity or an educational institution. The corporation, the corporate form in the United States in the 21st century, is a governing entity. And it exercises the prerogatives of governance.
Very interesting. Systems of government disguised as commercial entities.
Or as charitable entities, or as, you know, some of the think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and stuff, or the Chamber of Commerce, which is I don't know exactly what that's characterized, but that's a nonprofit corporation. And it is, you know, the lobbying and propaganda arm of the other governing corporations. So, you know, they're different forms, but, you know, they're, especially the large ones, but some of the small ones play it out all the time. Their role is to impose their view and to often imposed a certain way of, values and projects. You look at any community, say, that's resisting some kind of corporate project, whether it's a quarry or a toxic dump or a factory or a Walmart store, and you'll dissect that struggle. I think it becomes pretty obvious that those corporate entities are seeking to be ruling entities. They're seeking to impose their will upon a community. One other thing I would add, that the corporation is also a minority governing entity internally. That is, you may have thousands of stockholders and thousands of employees, but a few people effectively govern the corporation. And so it's a strange institution to be sort of the model institution for the country. It is inherently an anti-democratic organization, and that is sanctioned by the law.
So it's anti-democratic really in two ways. Number one, the people at large have no voice in the operation of the corporation, but also the people even working for the corporation, by and large, don't have a voice.
Exactly.
Very interesting.
More than by and large, if you're a corporate employee, at the moment you walk onto corporate property, you give up your constitutional rights. I mean, you have no First Amendment freedom of speech. You have no Fourth Amendment freedom from unreasonable searches. If your boss requires as a condition of work that you provide a urine test every day, you have no remedy to that. Either you do or you don't, or you won't work there.
Well, let's talk about the history of how this happened, because wasn't it true that in the early... Let's talk about the early part of this country, the American Revolution. In one of your essays, I believe it was Revoking the Corporation, you kind of suggested that you talk about the Massachusetts Bay Company, the Virginia Company, the Carolina Company, the Maryland Corporation, Pennsylvania Corporation. You kind of suggest that the American Revolution at that time might have been a revolution against or rebellion against corporate rule. Would you say that's accurate?
I think people at that time were very clear that the corporations that you mentioned, at least the Massachusetts, the Carolina companies, could add the East India Company, that they were very aware of the nature of these entities. They had first-hand experience. Those were commercial ventures to come to the North America to make money. And they were private entities. There was not a concept that they were to be run by the majority, that people had rights. Consent of the governed was not an extant concept. And so I think the revolution was a complicated process. I think there were some people who, particularly after the Declaration of Independence, actually believed that the men of property who were leading the revolution believed in consent of the governed. It's clear that the men who ended up writing the Constitution believed in consent of the governed of the governing class, because that's who they wrote into the Constitution, and they denied the majority of people many rights in the Constitution. So that between the Declaration of Independence and the war and the ratification of the Constitution in 1791, you had a sort of a crackdown by men of property, basically revealing that their real goal was to be rid of absentee ownership and control, whether it was by English corporations or by the English King and Parliament. And they did that successfully, and for that they had to involve an awful lot of people for the struggle in the war. But once that was over, then they consolidated their authority over the 13 states to form a government where a plan of government that they could basically control, and that they would hope their descendants would be able to control.
Now, is it true that that Thomas Jefferson was an advocate for an amendment to the Constitution which banning monopolies in commerce, which some people have interpreted to mean that would have banned most corporations as we know it?
I've seen reference to that, yes, in many places, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we had the revolution, and just to sum up what I believe you said, that despite all of the rhetoric in a lot of our founding documents about the rule of the people, you believe that the Constitution as structurally instilled the rights into the class of property owners.
Well, we have a couple hundred years of experience, of practical experience, and we have the language in the Constitution, which is sometimes vague, but we certainly have a lot of experience in the way it's been used and the way, for example, the Supreme Court has functioned. And again, to go back to what I said before, how long it took for active, organized, cross-generational movements, A, to ban slavery, B, even after people drove these extraordinary 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments into the Constitution, to take another 100 years to get rid of Jim Crow, to get for women not to get the right to vote until, 1919, effectively for African Americans to have the right, really, to vote until the 1970s. Why did this take so long? And I think there are a lot of people who agree, or pretty confident that the nature of the Constitution itself is about enabling, as I said, a relatively small class of people to make the rules, for making the rules as well as making the rules. And then also we've got to think, while all those classes of people that were denied rights in the beginning, African Americans, women, white workers without property, Native peoples, they started off without rights at all and, had to struggle, and still many are still struggling, but, for quite a while. And so the laws, the precedents, the constitutional interpretations that the courts gave really helped to entrench that power and make it even more difficult. Even once, the majority of people got their basic rights, we still come up against laws and precedent and custom and ways of looking at things, language, that still make it incredibly difficult to impose the values that large numbers of people, oftentimes the majority, would like to have in this country.
Now, Richard, if one reads the many state constitutions, for example, the New York State Constitution, there is specific language in there that talks about that people have rights or guarantee of rights against infringements by governments or corporations. Clearly, in the early days of this country, there was at least somewhat of an attempt to make corporations subordinate to the will of the people, or the will of the people through a Republican or a Democratic form of government.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that you would agree that today, it seems like the power has been transferred into this corporate form. How exactly did this change happen?
There never was a day when this country was a true democracy that was governed by the majority. So as we mentioned before, in the beginning, the power was in the hands of basically southern slaveholders and northern men of property, white men of property. And that they didn't need the corporation as a governing vehicle. I mean, some of them used corporations, but not much. But they had the government. They were pretty much, the Constitution was their plan of governance, and it denied most people their rights, and, it was pretty good deal. As people began to struggle, as slavery was abolished, as the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments were enacted, as labor started to mobilize, and as slavery was over, then I think that the men of property in the North particularly realized that they needed a governing institution, and the corporation was the ideal thing for them. And so they quite logically sought to clothe the corporate form in the same constitutional rights that white men of property had clothed themselves in with the writing of the Constitution. So I think the transition went from a slave state to a corporate state, from slave masters to corporate managers. That's the real transition in terms of where the power went. So it's not like the majority of people ever had the authority to do the governing in this country and somehow lost it to the corporation. The way was paved, given the nature of the slave state. And after the Civil War in the 1870s and 80s, we went through a little transition, but we came out where, by the end of the 19th century, basically, corporations had been redefined as the dominant entity under law, and the country really became, at the mercy of the corporate managers.
Now, slavery ended officially with the 13th Amendment, which I think was 1867?
Something like that, yes.
And a few years after that, there was a very famous Supreme Court case called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad in 1886. Can you talk about what that case was about?
Well, the case was a tax case. I mean, the county of Santa Clara was trying to tax the railroad company, different from the way it taxed people. And the lawyers for the railroad company basically said that violated the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the phrase in there about equal protection. And the Supreme Court agreed. And I think this was part of a pattern of many cases where the Supreme Court basically, interpreting the Constitution, amended the Constitution. This was 1886. In the same period, the Supreme Court was eviscerating the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments in many ways by, you know, using decisions in cases before it to nullify, to say it doesn't mean what it says. They were nullifying all kinds of civil rights laws and doing a bunch of other things. So the Supreme Court was acting as it was meant to do. It was responsible to a certain class of people, and these were people who were brought up in a certain way, these judges, many of whom have been corporate lawyers, and some of whom had been trained all of them had had training while the country had been a slave nation. So none of them were Democrats, you know, little d Democrats. And when the opportunity came up in the Santa Clara and other cases dealing with providing occasion for the court to, you know, wrap the Constitution, you know, deeper and deeper around, or more comprehensively, around the people running corporations, it did so. And it did so, if you compare even in that period, in the second half of the 19th century, the cases dealing with labor that came to the courts and the cases dealing with corporations that came to the courts, you see a total opposite in their approach, that pretty much whenever, you know, cases dealing with worker rights came up, the courts would strike it down. Actually, women's rights, women trying to vote, a woman in Illinois who went to law school trying to become a lawyer to take the bar exam and being denied, the court, free speech cases, pretty much the court generally decided against people trying to vindicate their rights under various parts of the Constitution, and generally did vindicate the rights of people operating in corporations. And that meant that the corporations were then enabled to go on denying the rights of people, because it's kind of self-evident that when a giant corporation, particularly a giant corporation, wields the First Amendment and speaks, when General Motors speaks, when Kodak Company speaks, it's much louder than when Bill Houston speaks.
So when you talk about corporate speech, do you mean corporate speech in the form of advertising and commercials, or corporate speech in terms of, I've even heard this applied to political campaigns, like that financial contributions to political campaigns has been equated to speech?
Well, I'm talking about both, but we can, I mean, commercial speech is important, but let's focus on political speech. I mean, when a corporation contributes to a campaign, whether it's cash money, whether it's indirect money, or whether it's advertising, whether it's contributing to a magazine or to a think tank that's publishing stuff, contributing to conferences, you know, that's a form of speech. And it is now protected under the First Amendment, according to the courts. But if we're the people and we're having an election, how can this corporation, this sort of legal creation, this fiction that we the people created through our states, if we're really seeking to have a democracy, how can we have that entity, which has concentrated a lot of power and wealth, then interfering in our elections? It doesn't speak for the shareholders. A corporation doesn't poll all the shareholders to see how they feel about things before they advocate their position and stuff like that. So, I mean, you have corporations denying the rights of its workers. It's pouring its effort into the body politic to influence ideas, to, you know, to write history, to propagandize in general, to tell us, you know, what the right values are, what to think, to define the problems of our time. And when corporations do that, we mere mortals have a very hard time being heard, raising money, in any way competing with that. I mean, just look at the contributions to any major campaign or even minor campaign, and the people are usually outspent enormously by corporate money.
It's funny that you say mere mortals, because one of the features of the modern corporation is that it has infinite duration.
Well, that's right. We live, we die, and corporations go on and on and on. And, you know, so that the people who come in there are relatively interchangeable. I mean, they go on forever. But, you know, it's a strange thing that it's sort of generally unchallenged and generally accepted. I mean, the fact that, you know, that corporations have constitutional rights, that corporations exist forever, that corporations play a major role in the governance of our communities, of our states, of our country, and that there's very little we can do about it. For example, in Massachusetts in the 70s, people ran an initiative in the state to ban corporate contributions to referendums and initiatives that the corporations didn't have a stake in. So it was a modest initiative, and it won. And immediately some bank and other corporations sued, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said the banks were right. The people of Massachusetts did not have the right to pass this initiative because it violated the corporation's First Amendment freedom of speech.
Wow.
You know?
And you said that was originally passed by referendum?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And, you know, there are many, many other cases like that where people have actually passed laws. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of laws at a state, local, and some at the federal level that people organize for 10 years or 15 years, and they pass a law that tries to define the corporation in a more limited fashion. And the Supreme Court is in the position, with 5 votes, basically to throw it out and say, well, this law is unconstitutional, or this law doesn't exactly say what the words say on the paper. And I think in various pockets around the country, these issues are now being talked about, and that in a few places, civic organizing is evolving in a new way, trying to build upon the historical information and analysis that a growing number of people, not just in Polkland, but a growing number of people have been exploring. In the future, I think that's where people's interest is what does it mean to rethink, and structure an organizing campaign that begins to challenge, not only deal with the particular harm, let's say there's a, you know, whether it's a toxic chemical or genetically engineered foods or whatever, but also begins to expose and challenge these, what we call illegitimate constitutional rights that corporations have, and the complicity, and even beyond complicity, of public officials in enabling corporations to deny people's rights. So in a few places, there are some things happening where small towns are starting to pass laws that deal with a particular corporate harm, but in a way that seeks to strip the corporations of authority, of this history.
Like what happened in Porter Township, Pennsylvania?
That's right. That's right.
Can you talk about what did happen in Porter Township, Pennsylvania?
I think Porter Township is a small township in Pennsylvania, in central Pennsylvania, where the township supervisors passed the law that within our township, the corporation does not have constitutional rights. And that came out of 5-6 years of organizing around some other issues where people realized that no matter what the laws they had passed, as long as corporations could stand on the Constitution and bring lawsuits, they could undo or seriously threaten those laws. And so they decided to go the step further and take the corporation straight on, really to provoke them. And what happens on a sort of human level, on a cultural level, what that means is that the people who are, you know, the corporate spokespeople and politicians and all the very important people who are from the corporate side, they have to come into that community, which they do, to say, you have no right to do this. You don't have the authority to pass such a law. This may be a democracy, but doesn't go that far. And I think that that's when you have important people come to your town and say that, it's a very provocative moment. And people, you know, pushes people even further into the democratic process. And some of the prior stuff there was that the factory farming had become a big issue in Pennsylvania, and a number of communities had started passing laws banning the corporate ownership of farms and farmland. It turns out that's a classic mechanism, both to stop the corporate farming, but also to put on the table and challenge pretty openly the claim that corporations have equal rights or more rights than people. And I think in the coming years we're going to see many more examples of very creative thinking and organizing on a whole range of issues where basically that, you know, people are pulling together the common thread of all these issues, no matter what they are, whether it's dealing with corporatization of water or mining or clear cutting of trees or whatever. The underlying thread through all of these issues is by what authority do public officials give the people running corporations special powers to wield the law and the Constitution against the rest of us. And we say, by no legitimate authority.
Richard?
Yes?
This is Mike Hudak, co-host with Bill Houston.
Good evening.
Hi. I wonder if you could speak about the Enron scandal. Has that been useful in your organizing?
Not very much, because both the corporate press and politicians are very, very skilled at framing issues like that. And they framed it as corporate excess. And I mean, it was the thievery parts, the sort of stuff that, you know, they broke a lot of laws. They also didn't break a lot of laws. But I've seen very little in the corporate press or from politicians, from corporate politicians, about the reality that most of the things that the Enron officials did mm-hmm. was perfectly legal. Mm-hmm. And one of the big areas in which they operated was they set out to change state and federal law and energy, really to reconfigure how we think about energy in this country. And to do that, they used the 200 years of history, the fact that they were legal persons, that they could use enormous amount of money to get involved in elections, to go into legislatures and lobby, give money to think tanks in order to come up with the papers they need, stories to the press. What they did was to propagandize in order to change values, in order to change the law, in order to do what they wanted to do. And it wasn't because they were so brilliant. It was because they stepped into the result of a long history that enabled the people and corporations to do that. And so the remedy was the Sarbanes-Oxley bill, you know, which requires a little more accountability or openness in the corporate CEOs now have to sign the financial statements and stuff like that. But none of it is about this whole question of corporate constitutional rights, about what a corporation is, how the people within a corporation are, in fact, denying us mortals of our rights.
Right.
So it was clear from the beginning that would, you know, it was not going to be easy to use the Enron case.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of your own organizing, as you've just described here, but using the Enron case as an example of what's wrong with the fundamental structure of corporations.
Well, we talked about it a little bit. I mean, Enron, it turns out that Enron Corporation is chartered in Oregon. And so think about it. It's actually kind of funny that the people of Oregon, through their state legislature, charter the Enron Corporation. And because of the laws in Oregon, the corporation itself then is able to create other companies. So they created these other, you know, three, four, five, God knows how many thousand entities, some corporations, some partnerships, whatever, offshore, onshore. And early on, I was trying to advocate that it is, in fact, the governor and legislators and attorney general of Oregon who were culpable here, that they're the ones who unleashed Enron on the rest of the country, and they had a responsibility either to fix it or the people had a responsibility to go after them and get them for the culpability. But I frankly couldn't get too many folks interested in that concept.
Well, it seems like that I'm aware of a case that Poklad, I believe, is assisting with in the district courts in Pennsylvania right now, where the defendants are partly the state of Pennsylvania themselves. And I think that my research has shown that you're using the 14th Amendment in a unique way, and that is to say that the state of Pennsylvania has misused the 14th Amendment to grant corporations rights, which is rather interesting because the 14th Amendment has been used ever since Santa Clara to grant corporations rights of persons.
Right. It's complicated because we and anybody else that's filing suits against corporations, you're turning to the courts and sometimes to the legislatures for a remedy. But it is, in fact, just as you say, it is the courts that have given the 14th Amendment, you know, and the First Amendment and other parts of the Constitution to the men and women in corporations to wield against us. And it is the state legislatures which have also, in their corporate codes, declared that corporations shall have the rights of legal, you know, have the legal rights of persons. So we're trying to raise that and turn it back on them. But, you know, we're asking those very people, the very institutions that have empowered corporations to deny our rights, to do something about it.
So we're going to the wolves to complain about some missing hens.
Right. Well, you know, that's another parallel to what happened during slavery. I mean, slavery was legal in this country. Therefore, the law was about enabling a few people, plantation owners, to enslave a whole class of people and deny them their rights. And there was no remedy. And even, you know, as over a couple of generations, an abolitionist movement built up. This is, I think, a lesson that I'm hoping that there's some people out there that are listening to. So over the course of a few generations, the abolition movement builds up, and the slave owners wouldn't budge. I mean, there was no remedy to slavery. It was written into the Constitution. It was in the culture. The slave-owning South controlled the national government, basically. There was no remedy, and if the slave-owning class was not going to even negotiate, what we ended up with was one of the greatest, awfulest, bloodiest wars in history. And I think we're in a similar situation, is that there is no remedy now, because the corporate state and, you know, all the mechanisms of governance are part of the corporate state. And they are the ones who have created this reality. I mean, I heard Senator Kerry a couple of weeks ago say, you know, when outsourcing was the story of the week, to say that there's nothing constitutionally the government can do, legislatures can do, about outsourcing. But what does that mean? You know, it means, can my community really make the rules about the economy in my community? We can't now. That has been one of the purposes, you know, one of the uses of our Constitution, which has been to deny majorities of people in their own communities or states from making the rules, to making the rules about how money is invested, how work is organized, how goods are produced and sold and all that. We cannot make the rules for that. And so what we end up doing is trying to, we pass the Clean Air Act, and we try to make what they're doing a little less bad. And we think, you know, early on in Polk Lab, we felt, well, that it wasn't good enough for the language of the Declaration of Independence for a country that's supposed to be a self-governing democracy. You know, when a majority gets together and says, this is the way we want to do it, it should have the authority to do that.
It almost sounds like you're describing Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, where the master loses control of the monster that he created.
Well, you know, except maybe we didn't create it. You know, sometimes our stories, our myths, don't align with reality. And I'm comfortable with the story being, you know, we start off as a slave state, and that morphed into a corporate state. And it's always been a relatively, you know, one class of people, a relative small number of people that have made the rules to make the rules. And so it's pretty logical that we ended up this way. And if we want to change it, it's very important to resist each of the harms, because humanity cries out that we do that. Because as Eugene Debs says, if we don't resist each harm, we become as slaves. But, you know, we have now, you know, particularly in the last 30, 40, 50 years, we have a lot of evidence, we have a lot of data that tells us if we keep just resisting each harm without opening up the bigger questions, without looking historically, without challenging all this illegitimate power that is wielded against us and our communities and the earth by a relatively few, you know, small number of people camouflaged in these corporations, then we can't keep up. And anybody that's had any experience with organizing in communities knows that we're always on the defensive. You know, there's always something else, some other corporate cockamamie idea coming down the pike, that, you know, it's another technology, it's another store, it's another this, another that, and people gear up and say, we're going to stop this, we're going to stop GE Foods, we're going to stop nuclear power, we're going to, you know, stop redlining, we're going to stop whatever. You know, we're always on the defensive. Well, when do we get to talk about our vision for how our communities and our society can be organized? Why should it take 100 years for a majority to say, this is how we want to do things? And how can we have a few judges say, you know, when a majority finally passed the law to say, sorry, this is about the economy, this is private law, you have no authority to even be mucking around in these realms. Anywhere you want to get into this, there's something, some aspect of what corporations are doing that has intrigued you or angered you, whatever. If you start looking at it with an open mind, and not get sucked totally into the technological details of the particular harm, and start thinking about, in the context of the discussion we've been having tonight, about, you know, how does this look in the context of the language of democracy, the language of consent of the governed, the language of majority rule. There's a huge literature now, and I would say start taking a look at it. On a more practical standpoint, we've started in collaboration with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund in Pennsylvania, who's worked on some of these laws in Pennsylvania, what we call Democracy School, which is a weekend school where we go into the stuff in depth. So if people are interested in that, they should contact POCLAD at 508-398-1145, and the email is people@poclad.org.
And there's also a website at that address, poclad.org,
That's
too.
Right. It's a very good website. And I think in that there's more groups of people who are actually talking about these things in the context of, not purely as a theoretical discussion, but in the context of, all right, what does that mean that we in our community can do differently tomorrow that might help us be more effective civic activists and more effective citizens whose job it is, in fact, to participate in the governing of our communities.
Richard, are you optimistic that the people might someday form a democratic form of government?
Sure. What option do I have besides optimism?
Richard Grossman, interviewed by Bill Houston.
This country was created with corporate charters. All Virginia, New England, even the Hudson Bay. Chartered corporations brought the slaves to labor. Chartered corporations rule the world today. All hail the charter
from which all blessings flow.
With the rights of a real person,
it is eternal. Bow low, bow low.
Humanity.
Humanity.
The greatness of a country is measured by its GNP.
NP.
Especially
the P.
When that someone getting rich is we.
Bountiful earth, we're using you up. We, we're drinking dry the overflowing cup. And that is the way that it must be. For it is we who are the end of his story.
Next, I'm going to read you from Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy, published by Polklad in 2001. The next article is titled, Dog Days at Company Headquarters, Business Accountability and the Corporate Charter, by Richard L. Grossman and Frank T. Adams. The Corporate Charter. Charters have been used by kings and governments to select who organizes capital, labor, and natural resources, and who creates wealth. In the U.S., the Constitution gives this power to the states. Therefore, we, the people, have the constitutional authority and a civic obligation to grant and revoke charters. Few states issue charters with anything more in mind than gathering statistics or taxes. So it is up to us in each state to force every corporation granted a charter in our name to operate in our and the Earth's best interest, or to revoke the corporation's charter. There is a rich, passionate, but deliberately ignored history of U.S. citizens trying to protect themselves against corporations. The privilege of incorporation was widely distrusted in the 19th century and often the subject of anti-charter agitation. As Justice Louis D. Brandeis wrote, quote, "There was a sense of some insidious menace inherent in large aggregations of capital, particularly when held by corporations," close quote. Nonetheless, during the last 150 years, we have been intimidated, snookered, or outmaneuvered by our charterees and their apologists in the legislatures, courts, and public relations firms. We have permitted corporations to become, quote, persons under the law. We have let them determine the, quote, social definitions under which their own economic wrongdoing is differentiated from real crime, close quote, as one sociologist noted. Corporations invest, divest, and destroy behind the cloaks of limited liability and business confidentiality. Like George III, They trace their powers virtually from divine right, equating corporate production and profits with our freedom and well-being. The legal tools available to us, as Yale professor Martin Churlstein has observed, become blunt and clumsy whenever management's business judgment is placed at issue. Consequently, workplace health and environmental laws are inherently limited from the very moment of their legislative birth. As far back as 1941, the Temporary National Economic Committee, appointed by Congress, understood this when it concluded in its final report and recommendations, quote, "The principal instrument of concentration of economic power and wealth has been the corporate charter with unlimited power. Charters which afforded a detour around every principle of fiduciary responsibility. Charters which permitted promoters and managers to use the property of others for their own enrichment and to the detriment of the real owners. Charters which made possible the violation of law without personal liability. Charters which omitted every safeguard of individual and public welfare, which common sense and experience alike have taught us is necessary. Today we need to ask one another if we haven't spent enough time, energy, and money niggling with these well-guarded, intentionally constructed, meticulously insulated corporations. Don't we harm ourselves in the earth when we let the very real monster of corporate law block our paths? Don't we demean the tradition of active citizenship when we give our rights away? Wouldn't it be liberating and exhilarating to reclaim our civic rights?" And that article was called "Dog Days at Company Headquarters: Business Accountability and the Corporate Charter" by Richard L. Grossman and Frank T. Adams. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. The title of this article is "Corporate Social Responsibility: Kick the Habit" by Jane Ann Morris. What to expect next from corporate sponsors of the WTO? There's a well-thumbed page in the corporate playbook ready to go. Whether or not it works depends on us. The last time there was a scuffle as worrisome as the Seattle demonstrations, Richard Milhouse Tricky Dick Nixon was in the White House. Nearly everybody else was in the streets. We were millions, and we demanded freedom, justice, equality, peace, clean air and water, and the right to choose our own hairstyles. We knew the joy of thinking it was all possible. We also knew the raw fear wrought by the pop of tear gas canisters, the glint of sun on gunmetal, and the meltdown of a peaceable crowd being attacked by the forces of law and order. But it is only at a distance of a quarter of a century that I began to recognize the depths of another fear, just as visceral. As I pore over the writings by and about the corporate elite of the day, a simple fact stares out at me. They were scared witless. While we wove our hopes into songs and scrawled our demands onto placards, they spelled out their fears in journal articles and speeches at chambers of commerce. The corporation was, quote, under attack as never before, subject to a tidal wave of dissident groups structured into onslaught vehicles of unrelenting social action, close quote, according to corporate literature. The future looked grim. Corporations were about to lose their autonomy, power, and influence. Some managers doubted that large corporations would ever be permitted in the future. The significance of profit margins shrank as CEO of one of the largest corporations in the U.S. wondered whether, quote, the corporation as we now know it will survive into the next century. For those whose greed commanded the rudder of the ship of state, the sight of people in the streets, and not for shopping, mind you, was terrifying. What a difference a generation makes. Large corporations have more than survived the tumult of the Nixon era. Today, a tiny fraction of the human population, in its role as corporate managers, has been exceedingly successful in using the legal fiction of the corporation to expand its autonomy, power, and influence. How did they accomplish this? While we huddled in coffee houses and church basements debating strategy, corporate managers plotted in boardrooms. Their diagnosis enfolded into a plan. From their perspective, a great danger threatened. Government action spurred by public demands. A tried and true strategy beckoned. Make a show of voluntarily doing something and publicize it shamelessly. This was a strategy with a thousand faces. Corporations as socially responsible, corporations as citizens with civic duties, corporations as good neighbors, corporate executives as trustees for the public interest, business leaders offering voluntary codes of conduct, and so on. There were three pillars to the corporate plan. One, placate. Two, co-opt. Three, reframe issues so that in the future people would demand something that corporate managers would want to give. Corporate donations and other forms of, quote, corporate social responsibility pacified portions of the community by softening the edges of some of the most egregious and most visible corporate harms. In a quasi-behaviorist twist, they rewarded good behavior and disadvantaged bad behavior on the part of showcased community and charitable organizations. But most of all, they enabled corporate managers to reshape public questions so that the answers were to come not from a self-governing people, but from corporate good citizens. Corporate executives were advised that they should be able to gauge with some accuracy the degree of social responsiveness that will satisfy the community, close quote. They were warned, if corporations fail to exert considerably more social initiative, they will be compelled to do so, close quote. The less voluntary social action U.S. companies take, the more it will be imposed by big government.